And I, of course, I shouldn't fail to mention that you are listening to WORT 89.9 FM Madison. Next up, BBC News headlines and then a public affair.
Hello, I'm Moira Alderson with the BBC News. A UN-backed report says famine is expected between now and May in the north of the Gaza Strip. Martin Griffith, the UN's humanitarian chief, says more than 1 million people are at risk because they've been denied life-saving aid. Here's Mark Lowen.
Israel has accused Hamas of disrupting aid and also said that UN bodies have failed to distribute aid on the ground. But we have had countless reports about how Israel has performed extremely cumbersome checks on trucks as they were trying to come in. It has limited the number of entry points for trucks to get into Gaza. And so we know that the criticism internationally has been absolutely directed at Israel. Today, the EU's foreign policy chief, Josep Borrell, said that Israel was using starvation as a weapon of war.
The Israeli army says it killed 20 Hamas fighters, including the head of operations of the group's internal security force, during a major raid on Gaza's biggest hospital. Palestinian health officials said a number of people were injured. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu told reporters the importance to him of victory against Hamas.
This is a war of civilization against barbarism. Those who want to bring back the Middle East to the Middle Ages, early Middle Ages, and those who want to see it go into the century of progress and advance in the 21st century. The people of Israel are united as never before, and this is something that should inform everything that we discuss now. United as ever before on the effort on ensuring that Gaza doesn't become a terror haven and a source of threat to Israel in the future.
Lawyers for Donald Trump say the former U.S. president hasn't been able to obtain a multi-million dollar bond that would allow him to appeal against his civil fraud case in New York. He'll have to find almost $500 million in cash, or the authorities can start seizing his properties. Neda Taufik reports from New York.
Mr. Trump's lawyers say they've approached roughly 30 bond companies and had spent countless hours negotiating with one of the largest insurance companies. But very few will consider a bond of anything approaching the magnitude required, and the remaining others will not accept real estate as collateral. Therefore, a bond, they argue, would effectively require cash reserves approaching $1 billion, something they claim is unprecedented for a private company. Mr. Trump had previously asked the court to instead be allowed to post a $100 million bond while he appeals the judgment, but that was rejected.
The head of a UN-mandated fact-finding mission on Iran has told the BBC it found what was described as the ingredients of crimes against humanity in the violent means used to put down recent mass protests. Sarah Hussein said the mission was particularly shocked about the use of AK-47 assault rifles against protesters. BBC News. Kidnappers in Nigeria have abducted more than 100 people in two separate attacks in the northwestern state of Kaduna. It comes just weeks after more than 250 schoolchildren were seized in the same state. On Sunday night, gunmen kidnapped 87 people in a community called Kajuru Station, while 16 others were taken from a nearby village. Croatia's highest court has barred President Zoran Milanovic from running as a candidate in parliamentary elections he's called for next month. Mr. Milanovic said he planned to run for prime minister as part of the opposition Social Democratic Party and said he wouldn't resign as president before the poll. Guy Delaunay reports.
Zoran Milanovic made no attempt to charm the constitutional court judges. He labelled them a gang of thugs and drunks under the influence of the governing HDZ party. Indeed, the court's ruling plays into the president's hands. It bolsters his claims that the HDZ and Prime Minister Andrei Plenković wield too much influence in Croatia. Mr. Milanovic must now decide his next move. Voters have responded to his outspoken and combative style since he took office 4 years ago. He currently tops the polls to become the next Prime Minister.
The chairman of China's troubled property giant Evergrande has received a lifetime ban from the Chinese securities market. Xu Jiayin is already under criminal investigation in China. Evergrande is under liquidation orders from a Hong Kong court as it struggles to deal with $300 billion of debt. It was once one of the world's biggest property investors. The Russian authorities are staging a concert in Moscow's Red Square to mark the 10th anniversary of its declaration of the annexation of the Ukrainian peninsula of Crimea. The move, illegal under international law, has only been recognised by a handful of Russia's allies. It's been used as a victory rally by President Putin after Sunday's presidential election. BBC News.
The 2024 Wisconsin Film Festival is coming to Madison Thursday, April 4th through Thursday, April 11th. This year's festival boasts over 140 films of all shapes and sizes, including the best cinema has to offer from all over the world and right here in Wisconsin. We've got experimental, animated, and student films, as well as documentaries, restored classics, films for kids, and more. For the first time in years, we'll be returning to both the Bartell Theater and the Barrymore Theater. Plus, we've expanded on the UW campus into Music Hall, and we are heading east to Flick's Brewhouse at the Easttown Mall. The Wisconsin Film Festival curates, promotes, and exhibits programs that showcase the art of cinema. A complete festival guide is available in the March issue of Isthmus and online, and tickets are available at wifilmfest.org. The 2024 Wisconsin Film Festival is coming to a screen near you, Thursday, April 4th through Thursday, April 11th. Helping keep local arts alive for almost 50 years, this is WORT Madison.
Six above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard before.
Good afternoon and welcome to A Public Affair. I'm Christina Leffering, news and politics editor at Tone Madison, filling in for Douglas Haynes. When I was a reporter at newspapers owned by a national conglomerate, I had a nickname for the first quarter after the new year: layoff season. Because that's when we would find out how many people would be cut. If somebody retired or quit, especially close to layoff season, we never assumed that they would be replaced. In fact, I remember being pleasantly surprised whenever we got the go-ahead to refill an open position. So even in newsrooms where I didn't feel at risk of being laid off, the problem was, how are we going to continue reporting the news when, year after year, the newsroom continued to dwindle? That experience is not unique. When national news outlets make significant cuts, it generates headlines. But newsrooms across the country have been slowly cut to the bone, particularly in smaller communities. Wisconsin Democrats put forward three bills to help bolster the flailing industry. They have little hope of being taken up this session, but it's worth asking, what, if anything, can policy do? Here with me today are Jason Alcorn, Vice President of the American Journalism Project. Jason provides support to news outlets that have received grants from AJP, including Wisconsin Watch and Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service, and works with local philanthropic leaders who want to better understand local news. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you for having me. Really good to be here and join the conversation.
And a very familiar face to me anyway is Tone Madison publisher Scott Gordon, whose piece for Tone Madison, Wisconsin's three local journalism bills are a flawed but useful starting point, prompted this conversation. Thanks for being here.
Hey, Christina. Thank you for having me.
Okay. So first of all, this one's for Scott. Can you just give us a brief overview of these bills and what they would do?
Yeah, so as you mentioned, it's this package of three bills, and three Democrats in the legislature, including Representative Jimmy Anderson from the Madison area, led the charge on this. The first bill would create a tax credit for people who subscribe to local newspapers. The second would create a body called the Civic Information Consortium Board, and this would sort of be a kind of a public-private nonprofit entity that would distribute grants to support journalism and media projects. And then a third one would create a fellowship program through the UW system. And this would fund, as it's written in the bill, it would fund 25 full-time, year-long journalism fellowships at newsrooms around the state.
Okay. So I'm going to open this up to Jason as well. So Let's kind of talk through these proposals, their pros and cons. And I'd like to start with the one that I think is probably the weakest of the three bills, the tax credit for newspaper subscriptions. So can we talk a little bit about, you know, what might be effective, but what is kind of flawed in that proposal?
Yeah. I think the first thing I would start with here is that, you know, successful nonprofit newsrooms, which are the kind of local newsrooms that the American Journalism Project works with, rely on a diverse set of revenue streams. And so the fact that this conversation is happening in Wisconsin is something that I think is really encouraging. It's a really encouraging sign that you know, political leadership and community leadership in the state is saying, how can we think about supporting local news as a public good? And so, you know, that's my kind of framing for this. You know, the learning and the experimentation is really, really good and really, really important. You know, this first policy, and I, you know, as a nonprofit, we can't kind of give a ton of pros and cons on particular policy issues. So let me kind of talk about how it fits within the national landscape. What it does is it's a way to direct, to incentivize people to support local news. And that is a good thing in general. How it's done in Wisconsin, I'd be interested in hearing from Scott on this particular legislation a little bit. What I look to in any question like this is the news worth subscribing? And do people have options to support local news that is relevant to them, that has information that helps them navigate their daily lives, that is kind of reporting on the news and information that matters to them and their communities? And as we look across the country, you know, traditional newspapers do that, but a lot of times traditional newspapers have also shrunk a lot and are not always doing that. And they're certainly not the only news outlets for a lot of communities that are providing valuable news and information right now.
Yeah, let's open it up to Scott. So one thing that you talked about in your piece was that one of the flaws with that proposal is that it's based on Wisconsin's definition of a newspaper. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, and Wisconsin does have kind of a legal definition of what a newspaper is, or at least a pre-existing state law about which newspapers are eligible to print legal notices that local governments and whatnot need to publish. And, you know, of course, this is a bit antiquated. And I think the intention was to have some kind of a door policy on this so that, you know, not just any rando could set up a newsletter and claim that people were eligible for this tax credit for subscribing. But yeah, it is antiquated. And so as much as, you know, newspapers around the state, large and small, are doing valuable work, this limitation means that the bill really can't grapple with the way that the news landscape is evolving. We have a lot more small startup outlets kind of like us, like Tone Madison, that focus on a really particular niche and are all online and, you know, have never gotten into printing per se. We have a lot of nonprofit outlets popping up. You know, we really have a whole different structure that is looking different. And also some of the companies that own a lot of newspapers in Wisconsin, especially Gannett, the largest newspaper chain in the country, and Lee Enterprises, journalists for their newspapers do a lot of valuable work, but there's a real concern as to why anyone would think that these companies would be good stewards of any sorts of public resources or incentives that are handed to them, you know, given the way that they've behaved and given the incentives that they have to, you know, just maximize shareholder return. And as you were mentioning in your intro, to, you know, keep laying off journalists and keep disinvesting in journalism writ large.
Yeah, I mean, I saw this personally, especially with more rural community newspapers. Like, I worked at a newspaper in rural Nebraska, and they really just treated that newspaper as a training ground, not investing in reporters who may want to stay there long term. I mean, yes, it's cheaper to live there, but it wasn't, I'll put it this way, a grocery store clerk made more money than I did at that newspaper. And so even though I really enjoyed the work that I was doing in that community, and I felt that that was reciprocated by that community, it just wasn't viable for me to stay there long term. And they build in this assumption that people don't want to stay in these communities long term. They assume that people want to move to bigger and bigger markets. And it's really doing a disservice to smaller communities and rural communities who really value their local news.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And I mean, I just keep saying that, like, we can't subscribe our way out of this problem with newspaper conglomerates. Like, knowing how much people pay for these subscriptions, and just based on my experience, that's not going towards reporters. Or a very, very small portion of it is going towards actually funding the reporting. So let's talk a little bit about the other proposal, the fellowship. Scott, do you want to talk a little bit about your thoughts on that proposal?
Yeah, at both the fellowship proposal and the Civic Information Consortium Board proposal seem really a lot more promising. And I think what I liked about both of them at first look is that these are both talking about, you know, funding on a scale of millions of dollars, which is, you know, what we would need at least for things to be effective. And you know, in both cases with these bills, you know, there would be like a body created that would hash out more of the specifics. All three of these bills that we're talking about today, the text of them is really quite short. And so they'd have to figure out a lot of things about kind of what, how things are placed and everything. But the scale of the fellowship bill is, you know, pretty, pretty great in my opinion, because they're talking about, you know, placing 25 fellows around the state each year, and each getting a $40,000 salary. And, you know, that has the potential to do a lot of good. I mean, that has the potential to have a lot of impact. And I like that the bill's authors are asking for bigger things and not just saying like, oh, a handful of fellows or a few $100,000. They're saying like, no, we need to put millions of dollars of public resources into this. And I agree with that. I like that it's not just a modest ask. I mean, it is a modest ask in terms of a bigger state government budget, of course, but I like that they're starting the conversation at this level of funding. You know, whether or not this eventually moves anywhere once control of the legislature, you know, changes at some point, that's a whole other conversation. But this actually makes it a good starting point.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that the good thing about fellowships is that just anything that puts more reporters into newsrooms without burdening the newsroom is a net benefit, because that just opens up the possibilities for what they can cover and get some fresh perspectives into the newsroom. My only real concern is that, you know, in my experience, it doesn't seem like there's a lack of people who want to enter journalism. The issue is making the industry so that people can sustain a career in journalism, so that, you know, we need something that addresses the bigger issues that make people leave, like the low pay, the consistent layoffs, and the instability that comes from that. And then with those layoffs, more work gets dumped onto the people who stayed. And, you know, there's a lot of burnout in the industry. So, I mean, it's a good start, but I think that there also just needs to be more conversations about how do we not only get journalists in the door, but how do we make them stay in the industry? Did you have any thoughts on that, Jason?
Yeah, I love that framing. And this is a program that I'm really excited about. There's a couple states that have already funded this kind of fellowship program. California has put, I think, 40 local news fellows in newsrooms across the state, some in larger newsrooms, some in very small newsrooms for smaller and rural communities, which we were talking about. Washington State has launched a similar program. And in both places, the demand has been really high. Communities are really excited to bring local news fellows into their communities. And it is a, in many ways, it is a nonpartisan issue. Red parts of states and blue parts of states all face news gaps right now. Communities are really struggling to understand, what businesses are opening up, what opportunities are there, how do you get help if you need help with food insecurity or housing insecurity. And so there are lawmakers from both parties across the aisle who are hearing from their constituents that local news matters, and this is a way to bring some public support into local newsroom in small towns and in cities across the state. So this kind of program is really possible and really makes a difference as soon as you start to put some of those fellows back into those communities. To your question, Christine, about how do people build careers? For a long time, working at a local newspaper was a really good way to you could raise a family being a local news reporter, being a journalist working at a paper. I knew people growing up who spent their entire career as a reporter and editor at a local paper. That's really hard to do right now, as you said. But the bright spots for me are, a lot of the nonprofit newsrooms, but also independently owned, papers and other media outlets. These are places where people are starting to see careers again, and it is really appealing. You can work from, maybe where you grew up or where you have family. You don't have to move to New York City to make or even Madison or Milwaukee to make a living as a reporter now. So a lot of the nonprofit newsrooms across Wisconsin are going to be places where if someone joins as a fellow now, they can stay in journalism if they want to. But if they decide to leave, it's also another advocate in the community for local news and saying that local news matters. And if they go and become, an elected official or go to start a business, they have this kind of relationship and this experience of being in a newsroom. And I think the more people who know journalists and understand what newsrooms are and that newsrooms are really trying to earn the trust and serve their communities really well, that's a good thing for local communities too.
Yeah. And with what you were talking about with, independent outlets, whether they're nonprofit or just independently owned, I think that that's where the consortium idea is pretty promising to me, because, if there's one thing that independent outlets consistently need, it's just funding. The question is, with a consortium like this, who's on the board? How do they make decisions about where that money goes? How do they define who qualifies for that funding? It's just something that I would need to see it really spelled out, what they're thinking in terms of who gets those resources before I would truly sign on to something like this. Do you guys have any kind of last thoughts on these proposals?
Just to say that I don't think we should condemn these or overlook the good in them, because they are a starting point. It's just that we need to be thinking so much bigger about changing who owns and controls media, and about, frankly, walling it off from capitalism as much as we can, from market pressures as much as we can. Because without that, there isn't a good future for this. There just isn't.
And Scott, I would add to that and say this is something of a mindset shift, I think. It's what news and information do communities need, and then who's positioned to meet those needs and to fill those gaps. And community-rooted organizations, ones that have community boards, motivated by serving their community first and foremost and have that as their core mission, are ultimately able to do that better than those that have a profit or a revenue motive, especially when that profit motive is not aligned with a community's interests. So that kind of putting community needs at the center and saying, do these proposals help meet community needs successfully? Are there trusted outlets, news outlets that this public policy supports? are really important questions. And I think it's a great opportunity for, you know, for community members to give feedback to their lawmakers and get in touch with lawmakers on what they need and what they're looking for from their local news.
Okay. Well, you're listening to A Public Affair on Community Radio WORT 89.9 FM. Our guests today are Tone Madison publisher Scott Gordon and American Journalism Project Vice President Jason Alcorn. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a call at 608-256-2001. That's 608-256-2001. And we are talking about journalism and how we can better prop up the kind of flailing industry. Jason, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the work that you do at the American Journalism Project. You work with news outlets such as Wisconsin Watch and the Milwaukee Neighborhood News. What does that look like?
Yeah, of course. So the American Journalism Project is the first ever venture philanthropy dedicated to nonprofit news. So I can say what that means a little bit. We make grants to nonprofit news organizations. We partner with communities to launch new news organizations in places where there's not an existing trusted, high quality source of news. And then we work alongside those local news leadership and community leaders as well to solve local news challenges, to kind of understand what the needs are, and then help communities to fill in the gaps and kind of find ways to have sustainable sources of high quality local news. So since we launched in 2019, we've built a portfolio of 44 local news organizations across the country, including four which are being incubated kind of pre-launch right now. And as you said, we've been working with Wisconsin Watch and Milwaukee Neighborhood News Service since 2021, and with, you know, the communities across Wisconsin to understand and meet local news needs through work with both of those organizations.
Okay. And in your work, what are some ways that you've seen governments, either at the state or the municipal levels, address news deserts or lack of local news? And how effective would you say some of those policies have been?
I think that, you know, as I kind of mentioned before, for nonprofit news organizations, a diverse set of revenue streams is really important. So I'd like to make this point, and then we can talk about kind of the role of government a little bit. Philanthropy has a core and sustaining role in supporting local news today, just like it supports arts institutions and cultural organizations and other direct service organizations that communities rely on, as well as commercial streams of revenue. So reader revenue and memberships and sponsorships and events. Nonprofit news organizations that are thriving and sustainable have all of these revenue streams, and government support is one of them. There are a couple examples that I can point to here. We've talked about the local news fellowships in a couple of places. There are proposals. One is open in Connecticut right now that direct government advertising dollars to local independent news organizations. So if a public health agency, for example, is has a kind of a public service announcement campaign around, say, maternal health, then those dollars can go to support, can place ads or sponsorships or messages in nonprofit local news organizations and independently owned local news organizations. And it's a zero cost program. It's saying, instead of spending money on Facebook or Google, support the local news outlets that are already kind of trusted channels and trusted messengers for a lot of the communities in the state. And it's a nice kind of editorially independent way to support local news as well. But, you know, backing up a little bit, the other thing I'd say, local political leaders and elected officials can be champions of this. They can talk about local news. They can say why local news matters. One I would mention is I work with an organization in Vermont, and Vermont had terrible flooding last year. And local government leaders came out and said, if it were not for VT Digger, if it were not for this nonprofit news organization that we've come to trust and that readers have come to trust, we would have had a much harder time responding to and ultimately helping people survive these terrible catastrophic floods. So recognizing the importance of local news in communities for whether it's arts and culture coverage or emergency response or civic information is a really important kind of bully pulpit role for local leadership right now.
Yeah, and with what you were saying about having multiple revenues and also finding ways to fund it that also maintain editorial independence, I think about when Elon Musk decided to mark NPR's tweets as state-sponsored media and the kind of reaction to that. I mean, this idea of state funding of media I don't know how to describe it, but it seems to put some people on edge or just to immediately mistrust the news outlet. So can we talk a little bit about how do you find that balance between providing public support, but still maintaining that this is not a government mouthpiece. This is still independent journalism.
Yeah, let me just share a couple quick thoughts, and then Scott, I would love your perspective on this as a publisher who's kind of gets to make some of those decisions and see how it might impact, you know, running a news organization. One is that public policy has always supported journalism. And yes, there's kind of public media as a part of that. And really, you know, federal funding for public media ends up being a really small part of what supports public media these days. But you know, public policy subsidies from the Postal Service since the founding of our country have supported an independent press because it's written into the Constitution that free and independent press is part of what makes America, America. So this is not kind of a radical departure to say, how do we make sure that there's a strong press to inform, to inform communities and to inform our citizenry, and ask the question, you know, let's make sure we do it right. But that's what I think a lot of these experiments are about, and a lot of these policy proposals are about, to figure out the best ways to do it. And that's exciting to see. But Scott, you know, tell me what this looks like from where you sit.
Yeah, the whole Twitter spat over the state-owned media label was interesting and revealing on so many levels. I mean, obviously the way that Elon Musk was applying that was very selective and very kind of petulant. But it did also raise this question of why does that necessarily need to be a scarlet letter that you have, you know, government supported media? There was a tweet that I mentioned in my piece from a journalist and academic named Stephen Thrasher. He's at ThrasherXY on Twitter. And what he wrote, I'll just read it right from the screen, is, "Why is state affiliated media something to be so ashamed of, but market affiliated, market dependent, or corporate owned media are not?" And to me that really nailed it, because obviously journalists reflexively look at the idea of government funding media as something that could really compromise them, and there is absolutely that danger. But at the same time, when we're talking about market forces and we're talking about large publicly traded companies that that own a lot of the media in this country and are part of, you know, lobbying efforts and make political donations and things, I mean, when we think about all of the kind of newspaper barons, past and present, who have had very explicit political agendas and connections, when we think about how many newspapers in this country exist in the first place because local and state political parties started them, this is something that's always been more messy and fraught than we like to acknowledge sometimes. And I think, the thing with public funding of media is that it, with any funding source, it's ultimately kind of the burden on the publication and the journalists there to really walk the walk and prove, yes, our money comes from somewhere, obviously, but the work we're producing is still trustworthy. That's a struggle to kind of to prove that to people every day, no matter what your funding source is. You know, I mean, I don't think there's a clean dollar in circulation anywhere, or a non-politicized dollar in circulation anywhere. And so I think tackling that honestly is just, you know, is the way to deal with this.
Yeah, and particularly with what you were saying about corporate media and advertisers. I mean, working in a small town where there's only so many businesses and they're often owned by people who have like a lot of political connections, like no one even has to say, don't dig into, you know, this particular company or don't report on this particular person. But there is just like this understanding of like, we get X percentage of our revenue from ad sales to this company. So there's an implied, like, I don't know if it's a self-censorship or what it is, but it's there and it's very real, and it can affect reporting.
I mean, also, if I can get in one other point, there's also plenty of, you know, for-profit news outlets that, you know, kind of shun this sort of public funding thing, but from day to day, they're publishing all of these, you know, low effort articles that are basically just single source stories where the single source is the cops, and that's being presented as authoritative. I mean, so if you're worried about, you know, falling prey to like the pressures of government propaganda, I don't know, start cleaning up your own house first, you know?
Right. And I think that, you know, when we talk about the scarlet letter of state-sponsored media, I think people just jump to thinking about things like Russian state media or Chinese state media. But like the BBC is also state-funded, and it's one of the most reputable international news sources in the world. So I think that, you know, this kind of broad brush that like state funding means that you now become a government mouthpiece, that's something that definitely needs to be pushed back against. All right. Do you guys have anything else to add on that? Any last thoughts? No. All right.
No, I think you tied it up really well.
Well, thank you. So you guys are listening to A Public Affair on Community Radio WORT 89.9 FM. Our guests today are Tone Madison publisher Scott Gordon and American Journalism Project Vice President David Alcorn. We're talking about journalism and supporting our flailing local news industry. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a call at 608-256-2001. That's 608-256-2001. So I looked at some of the American Journalism Project's research, and I found this statistic, quote, on the current trajectory, by the end of 2024, the country will have lost a third of its newspapers since 2005, unquote. So given that scale, let's also talk about some of these publications that claim to fill these local news gaps. I've heard a couple of different nicknames for them, ghost papers, pink slime. Let's talk about what those terms mean and why are those, like, what do those publications look like and why are they problematic?
Take two of those. You know, ghost newspapers are this effect that you may still be getting the newspaper that you've been subscribing to for 10 or 20 or 30 years, but it's shrunk so slowly you don't realize how small it is relative to what it used to be. And in a lot of places, that's still what newspapers look like. It's a lot of national copy, maybe opinion columns, press releases. You know, when we look at the health of local news in a community, we're saying, is there original reporting? Are there local journalists who know what's going on, who are going to, you know, city council meetings and school board meetings and talking to neighbors about what's needed? Ghost papers are things that still look like news, but don't have any of that kind of civic substance that is what communities really need at the end of the day. So that it's a helpful way to say, are you actually getting the news you need? Or are you just still getting a newspaper that, you know, it still happens to be published or showing up on your doorstep? Pink slime, I think, is particularly relevant to, you know, a state like Wisconsin that is, you know, in the crosshairs of all of the political campaigns right now. Pink slime are really politically funded, typically websites, but sometimes now print publications, things that look like news or newspapers, but they don't disclose who's funding them. They don't tell you what their political strategies are. They don't tell you that, they have a political end in mind. And they're not always very truthful either, but they're aiming to be deceptive. So again, when we look at the health of a local news ecosystem, if it's getting filled with mis and disinformation from pink slime websites, that's an indicator that it's a really unhealthy local news ecosystem. And we need to invest in local, strong, independent, trusted, and trustworthy local news organizations.
Yeah, Scott, do you have anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, one kind of, I guess, sort of recurring figure in the pink slime industry is a guy named Brian Timponi, who's a serial entrepreneur who, creates different kinds of media projects, and he's, connected to right wing politics and is connected to a lot of these pink slime networks. And Neiman Lab just reported last week that Gannett was actually going to contract with one of his companies, Advantage Informatics, to produce quote unquote advertorial content. And so again, it's getting back to that earlier point of, if we're giving public incentives out, how do we make sure that they don't get siphoned off by companies like Gannett that then turn around and sort of undermined the larger project, right, of preserving and strengthening local journalism. It's interesting because actually a little bit over a decade ago, I worked for one of Timponi's other projects when I was between things and just didn't really know as much about his whole deal or how this would develop and it was a strange time, and I think I was done with that after about a year and a half because it was just too stressful and weird. But I think the thing is that the amount of job insecurity and layoffs and desperation in the news industry creates an opportunity for people like that to come along and to try to get people to work with them because they need jobs, because they need to fill these holes. So it's kind of a weird cycle that feeds itself.
Those pink slime jobs also tend to pay a lot better than journalism jobs. At least the ones that I know of. It's another way of kind of siphoning off, like you said, the talent, but also the legitimacy of journalists who have worked in the community and built up a reputation, but they need a job. And it's an unfortunate position to be in, but at the end of the day, people have bills to pay. And as you said, they might not even know what exactly they're getting into. They've probably been told one thing in the interview process, we get funding from here, but it doesn't affect our editorial process. But when you get in there and you actually start working and getting instructions, it's a different story.
I like to give folks a question we get is how do I know? If you're a reader, someone in your community, and you see a news site pop up, can you trust it? It's not always super easy to figure out, but listeners can go look at American Journalism Project grantees who we kind of vet really closely, the Institute for Nonprofit News and Lion Publishers. Both Tim Madison is a member of both of those organizations. And those are kind of professional associations that say these are real journalists doing real news. But then also look at the about page. A good independent news organization should be willing to be transparent and disclose who's funding it and who's advertising it and what donors are supporting it. So if you are looking at a website and you can't find that kind of information, to me, that's kind of a caution or a yellow flag. An organization that shows who's supporting it and is transparent is much it's much more likely that they're a good, trustworthy source of news about your community and the place you live.
Yeah. All right. Well, You're listening to A Public Affair on Community Radio WORT 89.9 FM. Our guests today are Tone Madison publisher Scott Gordon and American Journalism Project Vice President Jason Alcorn. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a call at 608-256-2001. Hamilton Nolan, who writes about labor and politics on Substack, wrote a piece fairly recently that argues that public funding is the only really viable way to kind of turn the tide of what's happening in the industry. What are your thoughts on that? Do you agree? Do you think there should be some caveats to that?
Honestly, I do agree. I think that, and even though like Tone Madison itself is a technically like a for-profit company with a fiscal sponsor, we are a part of that like nonprofit news world. And there are, a lot of great resources and a lot of really helpful funding in that world. But the amount of need is still just in an order of magnitude greater than, you know, than what it's going to be able to address. And I think, an issue that comes up with the nonprofit world generally, not just in news, is that the mechanisms for funding can be kind of convoluted and a little too based in like project-based grants and grants that are only available to these very specific sort of preconceived ideas of what you should be doing. Some of that stuff can be really helpful, but it is less helpful when you really just need enough, when you're really treading water, basically, and when you just need like some unrestricted funding to, to be able to sustain what you're already doing. And there are some programs in the nonprofit news space that that do address that need. One's called Newsmatch, and we've been part of that now for 3 years, and that's an incredible thing because it just gives us matching funds that we can use as we see fit. And it's been a huge lifeline. I just think too, it just, what I appreciated about Hamilton Nolan's piece is that there's this bigger realization that market forces are not going to provide for us here at the end of the day. You know, there's some things you can do to get like, advertising and stuff and sort of work that system, but there's a whole bigger piece of it that we just haven't addressed yet on the scale or urgency that we need to. So as dire as that article might sound, I think it's onto something.
That I like, you kind of talked about how there's a role of philanthropy and there's a role of public policy, and they really work hand in hand. The exciting part for me is that we're at a stage where we're really understanding the scope and scale of the crisis and the need and willing to take some big bets. So right now there's a number of national philanthropies who have launched a $500 million campaign called Press Forward, and they're hoping that it is kind of unlocks or helps to bring another $500 million with a B in support from local and place-based philanthropy across the country to support local independent news organizations, in parallel with policy experiments and initiatives like, Wisconsin lawmakers are considering right now, is a really exciting combination that kind of together gets around that. There's no silver bullet for this, but together provides a really hopeful and exciting path for the future.
Yeah. I actually saw a presentation on Press Forward. I attended a Lion event in October, and one of the people who got up to speak, because it was open for a Q&A, asked the representative, let me back up a little bit. So there's kind of like three big chunks of what they're planning on doing. Like one chunk is just directly funding news outlets. Another one is policy. And then there's a third one that I can't remember off the top of my head right now. But someone was like, got up and gave a very impassioned speech about how, these corporate conglomerate newsrooms, please do not give them any of this money. And, you know, you need, like, please tell us that this funding is going to go towards independent newsrooms, because you can hear the lobbyists like lining up for to get their chunk of this cash. But and the guy just said done. You know, I don't know how solid or enforceable that is, but it sounds like, you know, he was kind of a high up in the organization, so it sounds like there is an understanding with that initiative that, you know, the Gannett's and the Lee Enterprises are not going to be an ultimate solution to the issue, and that to really build up news industry, we have to build up independent outlets. A listener, Jim, who's not on the line, called to ask what we think about local outlets such as the Wisconsin State Journal, the Cap Times, the Progressive. Do you guys have any thoughts about those outlets and kind of their models and how they fulfill the local news ecosystem?
Just kind of in general, or like in terms of their coverage, in terms of business models, or is it just kind of a pretty open-ended question?
I mean, that's what I said was literally what I have. So okay. I don't have any clarification for you.
Yeah. You know, I think the Cap Times actually has a pretty excellent group of people under one roof, you know. Really, it's got, you know, good local government reporting. It has, you know, an actually pretty meaningful investment in local arts coverage. Lindsay Christians and Rob Thomas, they're both, you know, just do so much work in a time where like local arts coverage especially has been just disinvested in everywhere. There's a lot of people who do valuable work at the State Journal, and the Progressive is I guess a different beast to talk about in this context, because it's not necessarily like a local outlet. It's based here, but it covers national and international issues and does sometimes get into state and local stuff in Wisconsin, because it's, you know, very much rooted in our Wisconsin's political history. But I think that they've also continued to, you know, to do a lot of valuable work. I think, you know, looking at places like the Cap Times and the State Journal, there's tons of great rank and file reporters. I think like some of the wrong people are in charge and some of the wrong people are in ownership. The State Journal is part of Lee Enterprises, which is a large publicly traded newspaper chain, not quite as large as Gannett, but still has a lot of similar dynamics in terms of, you know, lots of layoffs and cuts over the years, you know, and lots of siphoning of resources to shareholders and executives. I just can't stress enough how important it is to change that, structure, and, you know, frankly, have more small outlets that are owned and controlled by the journalists.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, even for as robust as the Cap Times and the State Journal is, their kind of bread and butter is local government and state government, and which is great. Like that should be the bread and butter in a lot of news outlets. But it also does leave a lot of things that, you know, other independent outlets can fill the gap. So, for example, like Madison 365 is focused on communities of color, and Our Lives is focused on LGBTQ stories and, you know, other communities that maybe don't get as much attention as they deserve in like traditional newsrooms that are so focused on, you know, going to meetings, looking at local politics, which is all very valuable. But there's other stuff that can also, like, I mean, I think the bigger thing is, like, yes, Madison doesn't have, I wouldn't say that Madison is a news desert by any stretch of the imagination, but, you know, that doesn't mean that there aren't other niches or other, you know, things that people can do that create a more robust conversations and understanding of what's happening in our communities.
Yeah. And I mean, I'd point out that WORT, you know, does an incredible amount of local news reporting with a small staff and with a team of volunteers. You know, so when you look at what's possible there, you know, just think about the amount of good that you know, these kinds of operations could do with, you know, even a little bit more investment.
Yeah.
Or unrestricted funding. Investment's the wrong word, maybe.
Yeah. So I guess I'll just open it up and just say, like, do you guys have any other last thoughts? We're kind of getting to the end of the hour. So I guess I just see if there's anything else that we didn't touch upon that you guys think is important.
I guess just to kind of reiterate something that Jason said, I do think it's really good in these bills that we're talking about that there are policymakers who are willing to start the conversation and willing to take the issue seriously. Like I keep saying, I hope we're just at a starting point and prepared to dig in a lot deeper, but that by itself is a really, really encouraging development.
I would agree with all that. You know, again, just thank you for inviting me on. It's been a lot of fun partnering and getting to know leaders of all kinds in Wisconsin over the last 3 years who care about local news and care about healthy communities. And the American Journalism Project is invested in Wisconsin because we think that there are incredible local leaders starting to take on this challenge and who have really the ambition to say, how can we come together as a community to solve it and to fix it, from from Green Bay and Door County over to Eau Claire and Madison and Milwaukee and kind of all the rural parts of the state. And so, you know, very, very glad to be part of this conversation, excited that there are some policy things on the table that people are exploring, but just appreciative of all of the leadership, civic community and news leadership in the state, trying to solve this problem for communities.
We have just one last minute question that came in asking about news outlets for people with disabilities here in Madison. I can't think of anything off the top of my head, Scott. We do try to cover issues of access and accessibility on Tone, but obviously with our limited resources, we can only do what we can. But I don't know of any outlets that are primarily focused on those issues.
In Madison, I don't know of any either, to be quite honest. I was at this panel last year at a conference about coverage of disability generally, and the panelists made this great point that, like, disability stories are in every beat, every, you know, subject area of life that you can possibly get into. So I wish I had a better answer to that question, because it is such an important thing for media outlets to be thinking about all the time. You know, it intersects with a lot of, like, the transportation and policy debates that we've been having in Madison
housing
lately, and housing, yes,
and aging. We have a huge aging population that's soon going to face a lot of mobility issues and accessibility issues. So yeah, it's a huge topic. All right, well, thank you so much, you guys, for joining me. This has been a really great conversation. Jason Alcorn and Scott Gordon, thank you for joining me. Jason Alcorn, again, is vice president of the American Journalism Project, which supports local news outlets, including Wisconsin Watch and Milwaukee Neighborhood News. Scott Gordon is the publisher of Tone Madison, which covers arts, culture, and politics. I am the news and politics editor there. And subscribe to Tone Madison's newsletter at tonemadison.com. It's only twice a week, so we are not clogging your inbox. You're welcome. Thank you to producer Jade Asiri Ramos and our receptionist Mary Jo. Your regular host Douglas Haynes will be back in a few weeks. Stick around this afternoon. Oh no! Hold on. I got to scroll. Up next is Madison Bookbeat. Host David Ahrens is in conversation with Josh Shepard about his book, Shadow of the New Deal, Victory of Public Radio. Well, that's very topical, isn't it? That's all for today. Thanks for coming. And right here on WRT Madison, I'm Christina Leffring. 6 foot 6 above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. 6 foot 6 above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. 6 foot 6 above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. 6 foot 6 above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take it to another mental level. 6 foot 6 above sea level. Hello, I'm Moira Alderson with the BBC News. A UN-backed report says famine is expected between now and May in the north of the Gaza Strip. The report by the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification says about half of Gaza's population is already facing catastrophic hunger. Declarations of famine are rare and require precise conditions to be met. These include a jump in mortality rates. The UN Secretary-General, Antonio Guterres, gave his reaction to the report's findings.
This is the highest number of people facing catastrophic hunger ever recorded by the Integrated Food Security Classification System anywhere, anytime. This is an entirely man-made disaster, and the report makes clear that it can be halted.
The Israeli army says it killed 20 Hamas fighters, including the head of operations of the group's internal security force, during a major raid on Gaza's biggest medical facility. The military also detained dozens of people in Al-Shifa Hospital. The IDF called on people in and around the area to evacuate immediately. Donald Trump's lawyers say the former US president can't obtain a multi-million dollar bond that would allow him to appeal against a judgment in his civil fraud case in New York. He now has to find almost $500 million in cash, or the New York state authorities can start seizing the billionaire's properties.